Good evening, godless sodomites.
These atheists are just enormously creative in figuring out things that they can do to give us trouble.
You are tuned into the Angry Atheist Podcast.
Let's find out what an atheist is according to the Word of God.
The atheist is a fool who has said in his heart, there is no God.
You're gonna eat your babies!
He's a committed active atheist.
Hello, and welcome to the Angry Atheist Podcast. Despite all the background noise, thank you for listening. Glad you found the podcast. My name is Reap. I'll be your host for the next approximately an hour. Before we get into the podcast, I'd like to take a moment to thank Richard Lay for contributing to the podcast. Thank you, Richard. You're the first and only person to support the podcast. I appreciate it, though. I'll try not to let you down. Right. I'd also like to wish the podcast a happy birthday. It's been 3 years, and we are on episode, what is this, episode 142. So, yeah, it's been fun, and I guess it will continue on because I'm not tired of it yet. So, we'll keep it going. And as our birthday podcast, I have a gentleman by the name of Andrew Wilson. You might know him by another name on Twitter, but yeah, he'll share you. He'll tell you what it is. You'll have to listen. And the conversation started out like this.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Reap.
Hi. Good, I got
Hi.
You.
Yeah, good.
How you doing?
So, fine, yourself?
Oh, not too bad.
Yeah.
Can't complain.
Yeah, just a relaxing day from you, really. A bit of housework and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah, it's Sunday.
Yeah, exactly.
Sunday's the day to do housework.
Yeah.
There? Yeah, because I know here traditionally, it's my family. We always did it on Sunday. We always had to do the chores on Sunday. But I guess it's better going to church, though.
That's true. Yes, yeah. I haven't done that for quite a while.
Let me see. Where do we start? Why don't you start out just by introducing yourself? We'll start out that way.
Yeah, sure. Okay. My name's Andrew Wilson. I live in Dundee. It's on the east coast of Scotland. People in the atheist and skeptic community probably know me better as Stushy on Twitter, where I spend probably far too long debating evolution and religion. What else can I say about me? I'm a programmer by trade. And in my spare time, I like to perform in plays and musicals and so on. And I also go to my local Skeptics in the Pub and Humanist Society and all that good skeptical stuff.
So you're a programmer, you said?
Yeah.
I thought you guys were all antisocial.
On the whole, yes, that's true.
Yeah. Well, my experience, but I know it's been pretty limited, but just from word of mouth or just the reputation that programmers have is like antisocial and kind of, I don't know, reckless.
Yes.
It's like the state of
they definitely have that reputation. It's It tends to attract people who are on the scale, so to speak.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because they just don't? I mean, why do you think that is? I think that they're just wired to like.
I think it's to do with problem solving, and it's a very, very sort of internalized job in some ways. Yeah. You spend a lot of time in your head solving problems, so it attracts that kind of person generally, I think.
people usually distract from that kind of thinking.
Yes.
People around.
Yeah.
And make it tough. Yeah. You can't have anybody like looking over your shoulder asking you questions while you're doing programming because you've got to pay attention to it all the time, right? Real close.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you can have just like one little thing wrong in programming and you're screwed.
Yes, exactly. So you have to be quite careful and be kind of make sure you've got everything right and that you've got the problem right in your head. So it's a definite mindset, which I'm finding as I get older is more difficult to get into.
Oh, yeah? How long have you been doing that?
It's like mathematicians. I think someone said that mathematicians do all their best work by the time they're 40. I think by the time they're 40, they've kind of... their brains have changed a bit and they don't internalize everything so much. I think as you get older, I've found I tend to become a bit more outgoing and think less with the left side of my brain and more with the right side sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
It seems to be switching for some reason.
I guess so. I don't know. don't know. I think I'm kind of staying the same. I just turned 45, and I'm kind of staying the same. The only thing that's worrying me is I haven't got everything done that I wanted to get done yet. You know, getting older, I think time's running out for something.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it gets to the point where you just have to sort of move on and have other goals and
yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's all right, though. So, so you were recommended by someone on Twitter, too.
Ah, okay.
That's how I found you.
I did wonder why you'd sort of chosen me specifically, because there's lots of guys on Twitter who are probably a bit more active than I am, and so on. So I was chuffed that you asked me.
Yeah, she was. She said that she reads your feed and that you're very interesting to read, and so she suggested that I have you on. So
okay. Yeah. Can I ask who it was, or is that privileged information?
I don't think it's privileged information. It's Godless and Happy.
Ah, right, okay.
You know who
that's
is?
Nice. Yeah.
She's been on the show before. She was like on the show. Shoot, it's been a while now, but
yeah, I follow her as well. I do follow her. So, nice to know.
You know that there's a huge amount of people on Twitter that don't ever tweet, don't ever send any tweets at all.
Right. Okay.
So you don't have to. You know, I'm not that active on it a lot. I'll get on it sporadically. I'll get on it and I'll be on it for a couple of days in a row, and then I won't be on for a while. And then I'll get on there and I'll see somebody was talking shit, and I'll get on there and say something back to them like 3 days later.
Exactly right. I'm kind of the same. I don't. I've recently been quite busy, so I haven't been on it quite so much. But I tend to find that the same as you. I find someone that says something that's completely wrong about evolution or something like that, and then I find myself at 2 o'clock in the morning going, "Shit, what have I done?"
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's too funny.
Yeah.
Too funny.
So it is interesting Twitter because it does kind of force you to sort of contract what you're, you know, to put what you're thinking into very concise, you know, 140 characters. So I found it very helpful in that way to help me focus my ideas and so on. It's definitely useful from that point of view.
Yeah. It's interesting how some people find it limiting and other people find it so that it's useful to help them to be more precise or more.
Yeah. It does seem to be that way. I have a blog as well, but I very rarely use it. Although I should probably start using it more because now that I feel like I've come across every possible argument there is there in terms of religion and certainly anti-evolution argument that there is. So it's maybe time to start expanding my thoughts into something bigger like a blog, you know. So.
Yeah. Now, do you think the creationists are going to come up with another twist? Because they keep on coming up with these new twists on creationism to kind of make it sound like it's new. At least they do here to try and get into schools, you know.
I don't really see. I mean, even new arguments that they come up with in inverted commas are not really new. They're just rewordings of old arguments, or and they reword an old argument and then come straight onto Twitter thinking they've got some kind of gotcha.
Yeah,
it's like we told you it was all wrong.
Explain because, this,
well,
atheist.
No, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, even atheists can't answer this question. Whatever.
Yeah, exactly, and it happens a lot. And I suppose the thing about being on Twitter is you're not really debating people who are professional theologians or whatever. You know, it is kind of congregation members who've come out of church. I think you notice it particularly on a Sunday, or I seem to. You know, like Sunday afternoon, suddenly there's all these tweets. They've
fired up.
They fired up from church. They've just had a sermon on how evolution's a lie or something, and then they come in with all these arguments, and you just think, stop and think for a minute about what you're actually saying.
They're all fired up. It's like they came back from a sports venue or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite noticeable. Sunday afternoon does seem to be quite a noticeable time for that to happen.
That makes sense, I guess. It's weird how many people feel like they need to come to bat for God and Jesus and back them up. And somehow, if you say something bad about Jesus, they're going to kick your ass because Jesus can't do anything himself, I guess. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's always someone put something recently saying, you know, if you want atheists to stop arguing with you, why don't you pray for them to stop? Yeah. And then, of course, the implication being, of course, that if prayer worked, then it would work.
Yeah, I was. We had an accident day before yesterday, I think, where a tractor trailer ran into a bus full of low income college students who had done really well in school, and they were going to this college to check it out. They were all low income kids, and it ran right into them, and it killed 10 of them.
caught the bus on fire. 30 of them were hurt. And I was reading the story, and then afterwards they had the comments, and these people came on with the, we should just thank God that, that those people survived, and we need to pray for this, and we need to, and
why did it happen in the first place?
I don't understand. I'll never understand that, how they think praying is somehow going to be helpful, first of all, and why you thank God for the people. I mean, it's just weird. It's like, it's a miracle those people survived. Yeah. Was it a miracle those other people got killed? And if it's God, and then they come back with the, well, it's part of God's plan, or God had his reasons, or the devil did it, or something. Well, did God have to kill those people by burning them to death? Because it's kind of a long, it's kind of a bad way to die.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I can't imagine how the relatives are feeling, and how that would be any comfort to the relatives of the people who've died. You know, it's very strange.
It is strange, and nobody ever seems to make that connection between the God. If God had to take them, if he had to kill them for some reason, if they had to die and it was their time to go, that's all well and good. But some of the colorful ways that God picks to take people, it's got to be bothersome. It's got to be bothersome to me. You know.
Yeah, I think. I think death actually is one of the reasons people turn to God. I think because. Yeah. It's inexplicable. It's unexplainable, and it's a difficult time, and it gives them what appears to be some kind of comfort. Whereas I think if you know someone who's lost someone, the best thing to be is just to be there for them, and it's almost better to say nothing in some ways.
You're right.
Than to try and say something.
Which is a good thing, because it's hard. I know about you, but for me, it's hard to figure out what you should say that would be useful.
Yeah, exactly. Because
you just can't. You can't say you know how they feel, because you don't. You know, to say that is kind of foolish. And you really, how would you comfort? How would you be comforted if you had that loss? And you think, well, there's really nothing that would be comforting. Time.
Yeah.
You know? Time is all.
Well, in Scotland, we have quite a large humanist society, a large number of funerals are now humanist funerals.
Yeah.
And the humanist funerals I've been to are a lot more personal, and about the person who died. Whereas if you go to a funeral that's religious, quite often you have to sit through readings from the Bible and so on, and a sermon which has got little to do with the person who died. And if that's what the person wanted for the funeral, that's absolutely fine. But I can't. For me, that's not a comfort, really. The humanist funerals for me have been a celebration of the life the person had, and I see that as far more comforting than just having readings from the Bible. But then I'm not a Christian, so I would say that, wouldn't I?
I guess. But I don't know how the Christians get any comfort from the Bible. It's not really a comforting book. If you're thinking something to read, it's going to comfort
there's
you.
There's certain phrases you can take from the Bible which are comforting.
I suppose. But
that you're ignoring a whole lot of other parts of the Bible.
That would be my problem, yeah.
Yeah.
We're thinking, well, it says that now, but I don't know if it really means it, because there's other parts that don't really seem like they support that statement. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think there's quite a difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament as well in terms of that kind of language. And God certainly seems to have changed his character quite a bit between the two.
Yeah.
And you know, you read a lot of the words of Jesus, and it's, you know, they're quite comforting, but they're kind of homespun sort of philosophy at best, really. But if you compare that to the Old Testament God, it's like, why did God suddenly have to change? Yeah. Did he do something wrong, or I thought he was supposed to be God, you know?
Yeah.
So what happened?
Yeah. He was a little bit too much of a dick.
Yeah, well, there's certainly some parts of the Old Testament you just think, there was no need for you to do that.
Yeah, it's like, what's the point in that? Hey, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if you were there, you just go, well, God, what the hell are you doing? What did you do that for? You have to do that. You just told the guy no.
Yeah. I mean, it's Noah's flood in particular that was one of the things that just made me sit back and think, wait a minute, what's going on? Yeah. You know, why on earth did everyone have to die, and all the fish, and all the animals, and all the children who hadn't done anything, and just because, you know, certain parts of the world were corrupt, you know?
Because God made it oopsie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
He's like, okay, you guys, now look, here's how it's going to go. I screwed up a little bit when I created all the things. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to get rid of you and start over again. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
You know, better luck next time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, none of you are worth saving. None of you is worth keeping. I'm just going to get rid of you. How would that kind of harm your self-esteem a little bit, wouldn't it?
But I mean, it's quite obvious when you read it. It's a myth written by people from that time period, because the boat's actually relatively small. I mean, it's smaller than the Titanic.
Way smaller.
But for people back then, it would have been massive, of course.
Yep.
But the idea that it would fit all the animals in the world. Now, if you've only ever experienced life within 100 miles of where you live, then it might well fit all the animals within that 100 mile radius. But you, what about the kangaroos and the pandas and the
yeah,
you know,
exactly. Yeah. And I want to know how people got all over the planet and didn't know about God if he did that. How those Native Americans, how did they come to be?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's records going back, or at least there's digs in North America that show Native Americans living, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. So what, you know, that's obviously like way before the Bible. Yeah. Well, at least creation, the young earth creationists talk about 6,000 years, but I mean, that's just ridiculous.
I know. It's incredible. Whenever I hear somebody say that, it's just,
yeah,
I don't know how anybody can say that these days, really, you know?
The evidence is just overwhelming. I mean, overwhelming is not even a strong enough word. Mm. It's the earth is an old earth. It's, you know, it is 4 billion years old. It's not, you know, it's, there's not a question about that at all, in the slightest. I mean, there's a debate over whether it's 4.57 or 4.58 billion years old, perhaps. But that's, you know, it's just, that's, yeah, it's just not in question that it's anything less than 4 billion, you know.
Yeah, they would have been better off if they would have taken the 7 days that God took to create the earth and kind of made that into a, like, maybe a scale, you know, scalable. You know, one day is equal to, you know, so many millions of years, or billions of years, you know.
And some people do that, but when you talk about, you know, you talk about your Ken Hams and people like that who really, they believe in a literal 7-day creation, it's just nonsense. I just find it really strange that people actually think like that. It's difficult. I mean, I used to be a Christian, but I was never like a 6-day creation, 10,000 year old earth Christian. I was a fairly liberal, you know, Christian, and I took science to be, you know, fairly accurate. I can't get my head into that space where you actually think the world's only 6 to 10,000 years old.
I wonder if those people really believe that, or if there's some point where they're alone sitting at home and they're thinking, man, this is bullshit. How long am I going to keep this up, you know?
Yeah, it's difficult to tell. I mean, even with someone like Ken Ham, I can't tell if he really truly believes what he's saying, or if he's gone so far down that path now that he can't afford to backtrack.
I was going to say, there's going to be some people that have the feeling that they are stuck with it, and they're just going to deal with it the best they can, I guess would be the way they think of it, because you can't step back from some stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And it would be such an, I mean, he's based his entire life, not just his career, his entire life on that whole thing. I mean, he's even building a Noah's Ark and a replica.
I know.
you go so far down a path and you can't step back from it. The thing is, I actually hope the Ark gets built, because once it's built and people see how small it is, really, it'll become really obvious that it couldn't possibly be true.
I hope so.
And of course, people. Yeah, and it wasn't just 40 days and 40 nights, of course. That's how long it rained for. He had to live, like, 7 or 8 people had to live on the Ark with all these animals. I think it was 150 days altogether before they found land, apparently. And you couldn't live in those conditions. It would just be impossible.
With all them animals? Man, what a mess that
was. No, exactly. And stopping the tigers from eating the pandas and all, whatever, or, you know.
Trying to keep them all separated from eating each other.
I mean, I once did a sort of back of the envelope calculation about the pandas, and I worked out, because pandas eat a lot of bamboo. And I worked out roughly how big a bamboo cane was and how much a panda would eat in a day, and I think it came up to something like 10% of the entire space of the Ark would have to just be bamboo for the pandas. You know, I mean, that's
here. I've got the dimensions of it here. It's let me see. 3 decks of internal compartments. 137 meters wide, and let me see, 50 feet. Wait, see. Oh, sorry. 137 meters long, 50 meters wide, and 30 meters high.
30 meters high. That's right.
Yeah, it's it.
I once said that I was debating a creationist online, and I said that, and he said, oh, "But it was all baby pandas and one mother." And you thought,
"Oh, come on!"
Even that, like, that's not even the thing. Is that he's just making that up?
Yeah.
There's nothing in the Bible that says it was baby pandas or baby animals of any description. And of course, it wasn't for a lot of animals. It was seven. Anyway, it wasn't, or 14. It wasn't two. So it's just. Yes, and people. So when people get into that kind of rut of believing that kind of nonsense, they have to start making up more nonsense to defend it. Yeah. Because just saying, "Oh well, it was baby animals," is just trying to justify it beyond measure. Really,
is that the point where you don't talk to them anymore about it? When you go, "Okay, discussion's over," kind of deal.
Yeah, you have to. When they start making stuff up, and even if you consider the Bible as evidence, which I don't. Particularly, but even if you did, when you have to get to the point where you start making new stuff up, then the conversation's over.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah. Kind of pointless. Are you to the point where there's some things you don't argue with people about anymore, just because you've done it so many times, you're sick of it?
Yeah. I mean, I see the same arguments again and again, and occasionally, if I see someone debating a creationist and they're getting into a rut, and they're I'll occasionally step in and sort of say, "Ah, but evolution doesn't say that," or something, or you know. And try and help someone else out of a rut, but I tend to avoid it, or I'll tend to debate people now who are at least trying to put up some kind of a reasonable argument, and they're not just using ad hominems or
a valid misunderstanding.
Completely da. Yeah. I think it was like Richard Dawkins said, "I would much rather debate a deist on the existence of God than a theist, because a theist has to defend some quite ridiculous assertions, whereas it is entirely possible." That at the beginning of the universe, there was a God of some sort. No, the thing is, nobody knows the answer.
Yeah,
that's before the universe. If we can use that terminology, nobody really knows. So it might be a God. That's a hypothesis that's possible. So it's perfectly possible to debate someone on that, on the different hypothesis, on multiverse, on brain theory, on whether there's a God or not.
Yeah.
But when someone actually specifically says, "No, it's a God, it's my God, and it's a God that interacts with the world now," there's not a lot you can say.
Yeah, exactly. To be honest. Yeah, and they're chained to the Bible. When they chain themselves to the Bible, they're kind of screwed.
Yes, exactly.
Although they've done a pretty good job of making it, of translating it to mean different things, taking the translation or the what word am I looking for? Making it so that it explains several different things, like trying to translate it so that one verse applies to a bunch of different things, you know, or something that says that maybe says kill your children doesn't really mean that. It really means just to punish them a bit, you know.
I've tried to make a sort of not a solution to that problem, but when you're debating creationists, they sort of say things like, "Well, that verse is literal," or "No, that you're taking that too literal. That's a metaphorical voice." So I've actually written a website. With a friend called versevote.com.
Yeah.
So basically you can go online, it gives you a random Bible verse, and you basically just vote on whether it's literal or metaphorical.
Yeah.
So I'm just slowly collecting data over time and see what happens. And eventually I'd like to make some kind of infogram or infographic or something that shows what verses people think are literal and which are metaphorical.
Yeah.
And I also ask people what religion they are, so hopefully eventually I can split it into, you know, what different religions think, or what people who don't have religion think, and compare them and stuff. So so that site's out there, and it's up and running, and if people come across it, they can vote, and hopefully over time we'll get enough votes to make some kind of decent infographic from it. So,
yeah, that'd be nice, because it's like it's interesting how things become metaphorical as time goes by. They become metaphors as time, as more time goes by.
Yeah. It's like a classic one is when thou shalt not kill, you know, the one of the Ten Commandments, and I'll never forget the order. I always forget the order. So, and when I was debating the death penalty with someone, it suddenly became thou shalt not murder.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know, I was arguing, well, this, you know, I don't really think it's the state's job to take someone's life. And he said, oh well, it says, no, the Bible says thou shalt not murder. And I was like, no, wait a minute, I've always heard that as thou shalt not kill until now.
Yeah.
So it's funny how translations change and meanings change depending on the circumstances, and
depends on what you're trying to support, your argument you're trying to support,
you know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
No consistency. Why don't you tell me the story of how you became an atheist?
Okay it was a long, slow process. It wasn't an overnight thing.
Yeah.
Even when I used even using the word atheist is a long, slow process in itself, even though I didn't believe in God. So, starting from the beginning, so I was brought up in the church. I sung in the local choir and got heavily involved in the church to the point which I applied to be a minister.
Oh, wow.
And I got accepted to Edinburgh University to do divinity, and I got accepted by the church to go for interview. And I got through to the last stage, which was like a three day interview, where you have to do things like sit on on pretend committees and take committee meetings and then talk about your faith and a whole raft of tests and stuff. And at the end of that process, they basically turned it to me and says, "We think you've got too many doubts." So I'll give them credit for recognizing the doubts before I did.
There you go.
At that point, the thing is that at that 3-day interview, there's lots of other people there, and I remember sitting in the pub with them afterwards, and a lot of them were very fundamentalist, literalist Christians, and I was thinking, wait a minute, am I supposed to believe what they believe? You know, they were 6-day creationists, and at that point, it's the first time I'd really met anyone who really, really believed
the Bible
in sort of 6-day creationism. And at that point, I was thinking to myself, this is a 3-day interview for me possibly being a minister. And at that point, I was starting to think, wait a minute, am I supposed to believe everything they're believing?
Yeah, yeah. Because that's not happening.
So the questions... So from there on, the questions just became more and more. And so you start looking at the Bible and reading it and then looking at translations and how do they know that this meant this and how many original doctrines do we actually have and so on.
Yeah.
And of course, over the years, you begin to realize actually, you know, like Noah's Ark story and so on. And you just think, no, this surely isn't right. So then I slowly became a theist rather than specifically a Christian and then a deist. And without labeling myself these, of course, and eventually just didn't really believe in God. And then about the same time, actually, I read Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene.
Yeah.
And I'd studied at my degree at university was anatomy, physiology, and biochemistry, actually. So I was reading that as part of at the same time, and that got me questioning evolution and everything as well.
Yeah.
So it was all sorts of questions like that in my head. So eventually, I didn't believe at all, and then I started. Someone put me onto the Atheist Experience show.
Oh yeah.
And I started watching that, and I started realizing, wait, I really don't believe any of this at all. And at that point, I started using the atheist tag. Although I'm an atheist agnostic atheist, if you like.
Technically, I think anybody who's reasonable is agnostic atheist.
But actually, I tend not to use that phrase for myself now anymore because it's not a word that's really needed. You know, you shouldn't really need to use a word like that. I don't happen to believe in God. That's the end of the story.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a long, slow process, and I think for a lot of people it is. I mean, I don't know many atheists who suddenly woke up one morning and had a sort of blinding flash of light, if you like, you know.
No, seldom does that ever happen, so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Now, would your family, did they care? Did that play any role?
No, I mean, like, when I grew up in church, I was the one that was most heavily into it. I suppose my dad as well.
Yeah.
My mum, actually, looking back, my mum didn't go to church generally, and she used that as her time to kind of be on her own and sort of
peace and quiet.
Peace and quiet, basically. And having talked to my mum since then, she didn't believe in God either, really. So, but my dad, I've talked to him about it, and he's still a Christian, and we don't talk about that.
Yeah, that's usually the best way. Yeah,
yeah.
Don't discuss it. So. But you're a skeptic, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's
more important.
I mean, I don't think I've always been a skeptic. I think I've always kind of taken things at face value a lot, and over the years I've become more skeptical, I think, which is, I kind of see the skepticism as the basis for why I'm an atheist, really.
Yeah,
I suppose. I'm a skeptic first in some ways, I would say, and the atheism as a result of that.
Yeah.
But I would also, I am a humanist as well, because that's the way I see, it's the best way I think we've got of building some kind of framework of how to treat each other. And,
yeah. And, you know. Fair and
yeah. But again, that's a product of not believing in God. So it's a kind of, it's a process, you know, I'm a skeptic first, then because of that, I'm an atheist. And then because of that, I think humanism is the way to kind of build a structure, you know, of morality and society and all that kind of thing. So it's kind of progressive.
Yeah, I think being a skeptic is probably the most important thing.
Yeah. And I think...
The reality, you know, dealing with reality.
Yes, exactly. And be skeptical of what you're skeptical of as well, in some ways.
You know? Exactly. Like, the biggest challenge for me is watching out for my own biases that I'm not aware of.
Yeah, you know? I think everyone struggles with that.
Yeah, it's going to be ongoing, I can tell, for me.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
You know, it's everyone has their biases, whether they think they do or not.
Yeah.
I feel like you're a really strong skeptic, but there's some things that you need to work on, probably, you know.
Yeah, and I think sometimes you don't even realize you've got a bias, and that's what makes it difficult. It's only until someone puts an opposing point of view that you have to think, oh, wait a minute. But I think what's good is, I think over time you learn not to let on, you learn not to hold on to ideas quite so dearly.
Yeah, clinging
to them. Like. Yeah, and I think as you get older, you get a bit wiser, and you realise that, you know, actually it's, you know, it's not that important that you that idea is absolutely right. I'd rather at least attempt to have an understanding of the truth rather than clinging to one particular idea.
Do you find that emotion sometimes comes to a part when you're biased? I know for me that the emotional thing always screws me up and helps me kind of bias because of an emotional reason.
And I think everyone does that, and I think that's the reason that there's these debates between creationists and atheists in the first place. Because I think people, religious ideas particularly, seem to get hammered in from quite a young age. So emotionally, they're very, very tied to that idea.
Yeah.
And so it does become quite difficult, because they'll defend it at any cost because it's an emotional thing. And it's painful to let go of something, particularly if you're living in a group or a community where everyone else believes the same thing, and all your social ties are tied to that.
And you've got no replacement for any of that.
Exactly. And so I think it's one of the reasons for being vocal about not believing in God, because I think there are people still in that situation, and I think America's probably one of the worst for it, where there are large communities where everyone believes that the same thing. And if people at least hear that there are people who are out there who don't believe in God and who survive after, after realizing as well, you know. There's life after believing in God.
Still go on, still have social contacts and picnics.
Exactly.
All that stuff. And that atheists aren't really the baby eaters and haters of God and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, just normal. Yeah. Pretty much normal people.
Yeah, totally. So, of course, they are normal people. People, you know, in the deep south, whatever, who are completely tied to the Bible and things, they're normal people as well, but it's just that they're brought up in this society where they're only given one viewpoint. And I think in some places it's getting worse. There was that story recently, is it governor in, is it Oklahoma maybe? Who's now basically got rid of the separation of church and state. That was a recent story.
No.
I can't remember which state it is.
I don't remember either.
He's now signed a tie between religion and politics into law.
It's dangerous.
It's very dangerous. It's forcing one viewpoint, which is just dangerous. And I think it is. It's so important that you hear lots of different viewpoints. I was quite lucky at school in that we had religious education, but I had a very good teacher who basically set up a philosophy club after school.
Nice.
And that was great, because you got to debate all sorts of different points of view, and she was really good. I mean, she was, I think, what I'd call a spiritualist.
Yeah.
Or, you know, she was very spiritual.
Yeah, yeah.
But at least she got everyone to debate lots of different viewpoints, and that was great.
We got a lot of the spiritual people here. I live in California, so a lot of those out here.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. New Age people and things.
Yeah,
which is fine. I've got no. I mean, the thing is, I have no problem with people being New Age or religious or spiritual or being a Christian or anything. I have no problem with that at all. I think it's when that single viewpoint dominates and becomes the way, you know, it's enforced on everyone else. Yeah. And
I have a problem with stops when it interferes with progress, you know, like stem cell.
Yeah, exactly.
When it does that.
I mean, I can't believe how many people are tweeting about the program Cosmos.
Oh yeah, I know.
I've seen the first episode. We don't get it here in Britain, but I've managed to watch it online.
Yeah.
But so many people are using it to try and it's difficult to put into words because there's so much evidence. There's so much evidence for evolution that when people oppose it, it's baffling. And the people who are trying to oppose it as well are as soon as you probe beneath the surface, you realize they don't even have the first clue about biology.
Yeah.
About even basic biology. I mean, they don't understand what a species is. They don't understand what evolution actually says. Yeah. They confuse it with abiogenesis. They confuse it with the formation of the Earth. They confuse it with the Big Bang. Yeah. And it's none of these things. Yeah. And it's, but yet they're so certain.
I know.
Which, of course, is the antithesis of science. Science is not about certainty. It's about being tentative and slowly progressing through lots and lots of trial and error.
And leaving yourself open to change.
Exactly, and again, like you said earlier, it's not grasping onto ideas emotionally. It's putting forward an idea and testing for it and trying to test against it and so on. And if it's shown not to be true, you have to let it go.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what that's a scientist's job almost.
That's the strength of it.
Come up with ideas and then let them go if they don't work. You know,
right. That's the strength of it. So. And that's what religious people try to use that. I love it when they try to use. Well, science doesn't know for sure, and somehow it undermines the point. And so it's like that's the whole strength of it, is it doesn't know for sure, and it admits it.
That's absolutely. That's why science has created, there's been so much progression since, you know, the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
Because everything's up for question, and it's tested, and, you know, no one questions getting into a plane.
Yeah.
But evolution is on the same... on the same level as that, but they don't seem to understand that.
Yeah, I like it.
You know, you can test genetically for similarities between people and apes, or people and fish, or people and bananas, and you know, and you can and it's not just like a rough count of genes or anything. It's a very specific comparison between very specific genes and which ones exist in both animals and which ones don't, and how much ones specific genes have changed, and you can come up with a very, very detailed tree of life based purely on the comparison of genes, and every fossil that's ever been found fits that tree. There isn't one fossil that doesn't fit that tree. Now, if that's not evidence, you know, what is?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I love it when people say, "Well, you can't trust those scientists. Can't trust science," as they do it on the computer, you know, from thousands of miles away, sending it to people from across the globe.
Yeah.
You can't trust science. It's like, how do you think you've been sending that message out right now? How do you think you came to be able to do that?
You're sitting debating across, you know, And not only that, the signal at some point is probably going through a satellite and up into space. Yeah, and you're like, you know, it's like, oh, for goodness sake, you know.
How do you think those things we got to make those things, you know? It's that science did that. And it's not exactly the same science, maybe, but the method is the same. The method they use is the same.
Yes, it's the method, and it's the methodology. And I think people don't understand that, I think, about science. Because I think I think programs like Cosmos are maybe helping a bit, but... a lot of science in the public eye is sort of lots of whizzes and bangs and like, isn't this great? We know this now, and here's the fact, and all that sort of thing, which are kind of the results of science. But actually, what needs to be in the public eye is the methodology and how we know what we know. Not just what we know, but how we know that to be
true. How we came to know.
Exactly. And it's I think people, and I think again, science in schools. I don't know about America, but. Certainly basic science is quite often taught as here's what we know, whereas I sometimes think the methodology would be far better and actually, you know,
at least starting with that, because we do kind of jump into here's what we know, everybody jumps ahead. We don't bother going into how we got to know it. We just know these things now, so we just accept it and go from there. So
I mean, even basic things that like we had when I was in chemistry, one of the first things we did was we were given this box, and inside was a ball. And you had to rotate the box around and listen for the ball falling, and let it drop, and then you had to drop what you thought was inside.
Yeah.
And then once you were finished and you were sure you'd worked out what was inside, you took the box apart and you could see what was inside, like, and it was a set of like ramps that the ball could fall down.
Yeah.
And so it let you see how you work things out without knowing, without seeing them.
Yeah.
So like, how, you know, how do we know electrons exist? It's because we've worked out in the same way as we worked out that, but you know, used that box. We could just from listening and from working out where the ball was going, just from hearing it, you know, you could work out what was inside the box. In the same way, when we know electrons exist, because we can see the effects of it, rather than, you know, so all these like, science certainly now deals with lots of unseen things.
Yep.
That we can only measure the effects of, and I think that confuses people. You know, things like, you know, measuring for quarks and for the Higgs boson and so on.
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
completely unseen, but we can see the effects of them. So, but people don't quite get that.
No, they don't. And then they think that if you can measure that, you should be able to test God too, when God's an untestable thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
They don't make that connection there. And I don't know. I don't know. People are. Maybe they're just too lazy. Maybe they're never going to pay attention to that.
Yeah, or lazy or busy or not motivated by the religion or whatever it is. I wouldn't necessarily automatically say they were lazy. I think it's just not out there enough.
Yeah,
I think if it was just out there more. But then, of course, you put it out there, you have programs like Cosmos, and people immediately complain. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Cosmos will help that much, though, because won't it be just kind of it's going to attract people who are going to be interested in it, and then other people who aren't interested in it are kind of going to deny it anyways.
I think like all these things, the people who are open to change will look at it and sway them. Think about it.
Yeah.
So that there'll be people who perhaps are in some kind of fundamentalist like home, or they're in a community that's very fundamentalist Christian. Who are very anti-evolution, but they maybe have doubts themselves.
Yeah.
They'll watch this and actually start thinking for themselves a little bit.
Yeah.
The hope is, I suppose, it'll attract people who already have a few doubts. It certainly won't attract people who are, you know, absolutely firm in their faith and so on. And you know, like Ken Ham's never going to be convinced by a program like Cosmos, you know.
That poor guy.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm embarrassed for him.
Yeah, and I have to say that the debate between him and Bill Nye.
Yeah.
I watched it live, and I did feel a bit sorry for Ken Ham, because, you know, Bill Nye had everything on his side, and Ken Ham could only turn around and say, "Well, there's this book, you know," and it's like, "Oh, what?
Yeah.
You can't. That's not an argument."
Yeah.
So
I do feel kind of bad for him.
It's a. Yeah, I did. I felt a bit sorry, because I thought he's not got a chance, because the evidence is just so overwhelming. You know?
Yeah,
it's
getting harder and harder, isn't it, for them to to argue that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, well, hopefully, what will happen though is that as people let him move on, and you know, eventually, you know, in 30, 40 years' time, he'll be gone.
That's what I was saying. We're waiting for the old people to die off. Yeah.
But hopefully the younger generation are a little bit more skeptical. That's my hope.
Do you get that feeling there?
Pardon?
Do you get the feeling there that the young people are less religious than they have been in the past? I mean,
well, I think it's certainly true in Britain. I don't know. I don't know enough about America, but
it is happening here. Yeah,
It seems to go hand in hand with people being skeptical of authority generally.
Yeah.
And I think in this country, people are fed up with politicians, and it sort of goes hand in hand with that.
The Catholics kind of helped with that too, didn't they? The Catholic Church, when they're dealing with the pedophile thing, didn't that help?
I think
some people off.
The problem, I mean, it's not necessarily the case that pedophilia is more prevalent in the Catholic Church, but I think it's how the Catholic Church dealt with it problem.
Yeah.
Let's take some other large organization, let's say Walmart or something.
Yeah.
And let's say a Walmart employee had been basically abusing children. Walmart.
Shit.
Much as I'm not a Walmart fan Walmart at least would have reported that to the police, and it would have been out in the open and all the rest
of
it.
Yeah, Walmart would have been nailed bad for that by the public. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, the church don't seem to grasp that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, if you just dealt with this openly and sort of said, oh shit, we've got a problem, we need to bring the police in, we need to sort this out, I think people would have been genuinely more appreciative. But
exactly.
It's the way they dealt with it that's the problem.
And I can kind of understand at first them being that way, because when have they ever been answerable for anything, really, where there's something that they, you know, couldn't overcome just by saying, oh, never mind, nothing to see here, you know? But then after
thinking when you actually, when you literally believe that your leader has a direct telephone line to God, I think it's difficult to question it. I know I've got quite a few Catholic friends, and most of them don't believe absolutely everything the Catholic Church tells them, actually.
Yeah.
You know, they're really not, they're not as ingrained in the Catholic faith as I think the Catholic faith would like to think.
Exactly, yeah, because a lot of Catholics like that.
Within the Catholic Church, there's a wide range of what people believe. Yeah. Like, I'm not sure how many Catholics actually believe that the wafer actually turns into the real blood of the real body of Christ. I'd love to see some figures on that, actually. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, me too, but it'd be disturbing if there really were people who thought that, wouldn't it? It'd be kind of weird.
Yeah, exactly. I know.
Yeah, we might have to put those people aside and have them talk to somebody about that, because it's creepy, really, kind of, to me.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, that's the main bone of contention between the Catholics and the Protestants, of course, is that the Protestants see that as a metaphor and the Catholics took it literally. Lots of other things as well, of course, but that's kind of the one thing.
Is it?
That's very strange. I mean, when I was at university, I had a girlfriend who was Catholic, and I went to Mass with her, and when it came to communion, I got up to go and take communion, and my girlfriend almost screamed at me. She sort of went, "No!" almost see it in slow motion. She sort of grabbed me back, because I wasn't allowed, because I was brought up in the Protestant faith, I wasn't allowed to take communion, because I didn't literally believe it was the body and blood of Christ.
And what would happen if you
which
had?
I didn't, at the time I didn't realize. Yeah, so there's all sorts of splits in the church, so it's like, yeah, that was just one of them.
what would happen to you if you did it and you weren't supposed to? Something would happen or nothing?
If I took it and they found out I'd taken it, I don't know. If I just walked into a Catholic church next Sunday, in a Catholic church in an area where nobody knew me, and went and took communion, I don't think anything would happen. But if I took it and they then found out I wasn't Catholic, I'm not sure what the repercussions are.
They beat you up?
Because they can't excommunicate me because I'm not Catholic. Yeah. So I don't know.
Okay, come outside. We're going to have to beat your ass now. Come on outside.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
God has said we got to beat you up. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. The Ash thing is weird too. The Ash Wednesday thing. What is that? I can't remember.
Yeah. People used to come into school when I was a kid with the cross on their forehead in Ash. And it's just a symbolic thing, isn't it? Really, but
it's just weird.
Yeah.
I guess Easter's coming up.
I've got nothing against symbolism in some ways. You know, it's like Like, for instance, funerals, people who are not religious still have funerals because there's a symbolic thing of
exactly,
you know, remembering the person's life, and it's the start of the sort of grieving process and all the rest of it. So I've got nothing against symbolism as such, but it's just what the symbolism represents. On Ash Wednesday, it was just, it's a bit strange that, you're being reminded of a rather gruesome execution, which the Romans, the figures I heard were the Romans around that time executed about 2,000 to 3,000 people a year by crucifixion. So, you know, it wasn't unusual at the time, and lots of people went through it. So there was, why are you remembering this particular one crucifixion?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
and man, what a nasty way to kill somebody, that crucifixion too, man.
You
look into the horrible process that somebody goes through when they, oh man.
I mean, and it's such a horrendous way to execute someone that they actually, whipping you beforehand apparently was a sign of mercy, because it killed you. It basically half killed you before you were crucified anyway. What a horrible, horrible way to kill
you
someone.
If I remember right, you suffocate from your own weight, right? From the pulling on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's so bad.
And you'd think, you know, it's like the last thing, if Jesus was real and he came back, the last thing he's wanting to see, surely, would be lots of crosses around people's necks.
He'd be like, what the fuck's wrong? What the hell are you guys doing? He tried to tear out. Be like, trigger warning, yeah. Jesus, trigger warning.
Yeah, trigger warning, yes, exactly.
Yeah. I'm going to use and that line.
I mean, if you've been executed today, it would have been, say, by electric chair or something. Yeah. Like, people be having electric chairs around their necks. And
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. There's an awesome cartoon in there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure I've seen it. Yeah.
Trigger warning, Jesus, trigger warning. Before you come down, we want to let you know there's a bunch of crosses around here, so we don't want you to have any flashbacks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's funny. Okay, we're almost up on time, but before I let you go, is there some parting words you'd like to give the listening audience? Words of wisdom or some insight or
advice? Just question everything, I suppose. Always look at what you think and try and see if, you know, question it. Don't just take things at face value, which I think we're all guilty of doing, of course, but, yep. You know, just question it, basically.
Now, yeah. If people want to find you, they can find you on Twitter?
Yeah, it's just Stooshie, which is Stooshie. Or they can go to about.me/AndrewRWilson.
Oh, yeah, that about's pretty cool, actually. I have one of those myself.
So that's
when it comes in handy.
Yeah, that has a link to like my Facebook and my Twitter and my blog and everything like that. So not that there's a lot on my blog.
there'll be links to all that on the podcast description too for anybody listening who wants to find it.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you.
No, thanks for hanging out with
so,
me.
So if anyone wants to say hi on Twitter, then just go ahead and say hi. That'd be great. Look forward to speaking to new people and things. That'd be good.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Hey, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
No, it was great. And thank you for phoning.
My pleasure. And I'll see you on the internet.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
And there you have it, the conclusion of the Angry Atheist podcast. I know it makes me sad too, but there'll be another. And I'd like to thank Andrew for hanging out with me for an hour. That was kind of him to take the time out. And I want to thank Godless and Happy for recommending Andrew to me. It was an interesting conversation. And I want to thank you for listening. And I want to thank you ahead of time for sharing the podcast with your friends, neighbors, friends, and enemies. Animals, stray animals. They might want something to listen to, right? Right. And it's been 3 years. So thanks for all the support. And I want to thank all the guests that I've had on because they've all been very kind. And I've had a couple issues, but nothing serious, nothing enough that would make me sorry that I became involved in this. And I'm not sure what effect it's had on the world. I'm not sure how many people it's entertained or how many people have enjoyed it, but I've enjoyed it, if that counts for anything. And hopefully, if you're listening and you listen more than once, you have too, and that's a good thing. So thanks for that, because this has been really fun. I've met so many people. I've met a lot of people doing this. So I just wanted to take a minute to say that. And don't forget to show your support for podcasts and blogs. And activists who are doing work that you believe in, make sure you support those people. Even if it's just kind words, a thank you, or I enjoy this, or this helped me, or I, you know, anything. I found this useful because sometimes we don't know what the hell we're doing or if anybody's listening or cares, you know? What a lonely feeling that is. Okay, maybe a little dramatic, but, you know, it feels good when people, you know, you're doing good and people are enjoying what you're doing. So make sure you tell those people, all right? Okay, and I'll quit blabbing and... I'll see you in the next podcast.